Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, longline ocean fishers take steps to save the albatross. We go trout fishing in a creek in northern Michigan. The environment is a major factor in the appalling war in Rwanda. And Amory Lovins plans a pollution-free car and eliminates the electric utility industry all at once. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Approximately 180,000 seabirds are being killed each year because they're being caught in fishing lines. A major portion of these birds are all 13 species of albatross, some of which are close to extinction. The entire population of the short-tailed albatross is down to about 700 birds. 10% of the wandering albatross population is being killed annually. The problem is fishing lines, known as long lines, which are used primarily in the Pacific. These lines are strung out behind boats and are many miles in length. Hooks, which can number in the thousands, are attached at intervals on the line and then baited. As the lines string out behind the ship and before they sink, birds will come down, grab the bait, and get caught by the fishhook. One group of longline fishermen who ship out of Seattle in freezer ships and bottom fish of the Bering Sea for cod have formed a group which they call the North Pacific Longline Association. Unlike most trade associations, which spend their time fighting or trying to eliminate regulations, the Pacific longliners are drafting regulations which they want to have implemented to protect seabirds. Thorne Smith is executive director of the North Pacific Longline Association based in Seattle, and he describes their approach.
Last year we caught something called a short-tailed albatross, and I quite frankly had never heard of a short-tailed albatross, nor had I any notion that we even caught birds. I went over to the Alaska Fisheries Science Center and spoke with the director, who informed me that this was an endangered species. Used to be a federal fisheries lawyer and had responsibility for enforcing the Endangered Species Act, and needless to say, that set off some lights in my head. So we began to study the issue and discovered that there had, in fact, been some regulations implemented pursuant to a treaty under something called the Antarctic Marine Living Resources Convention Act of 1984, that imposed a number of bird avoidance techniques on fisheries taking place in the Antarctic for vessels of the countries that are signatory to the treaty. So we developed some regulations modeled on those, which would require that we do some pretty obvious things like use adequate weight to make our hooks sink rapidly so birds can't get them, using only minimum ship lights at night so we don't illuminate the bait and track birds to the lights themselves. Discharge of offal from fish processing has to be discharged on the other side of the boat from where we're hauling our fish in or behind the hauler so we don't draw birds in that way. And we're going to come up with some regulations prescribing how you could carefully release birds if you do happen to catch one. So that's basically the course we've taken, and we have gone ahead and asked the North Pacific Council to implement these regulations by emergency rule. They have responded positively. The National Marine Fisheries Service has already assigned a staffer to work on this. So we anticipate that between the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, we'll probably have regulations in place early next year to require that we use these bird avoidance devices.
Experts in environmental organizations are optimistic that the bird catch can be brought under control, primarily because it is the fishermen themselves that are looking for solutions. They do say that one of the major things that got fishermen moving was concern that if the bird kill was not stopped, the fishery might ultimately be shut down through operation of the Endangered Species Act as the albatross populations diminish.
I think with the long lines and the birds in the North Pacific and in New Zealand, we're going to find that fishermen, by using both technology and operating procedures both, will figure out a way to not capture birds.
That was Suzanne Uticello, Vice President for Program at the Center for Marine Conservation. Concern about random killing of the albatross is not new. In 1798, poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge wrote the poem The Ancient Mariner, who was becalmed in a scorching sea for killing an albatross. Audubon ornithologist Susan Drennan says Coleridge described the wandering albatross, a species now under great stress from longline fishing. Coleridge's message should inspire modern longline fishermen. English teacher Dick Nunley from Berkshire Community College prepared this commentary.
To Samuel Taylor Coleridge, we owe the image of an albatross hanging around a man's neck to signify the persistent consequences of a morally heedless act. In the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, the mariner recounts how he wantonly shot an albatross. When, as a result, the ship is becalmed and their water runs out and the sailors begin to drop dead, the crew hang the albatross around the mariner's neck. He alone does not die. Only when spontaneously one day he feels love for the water snakes writhing on the ocean's surface does the albatross fall from his neck, and he returns to spend the rest of his life in roving to tell unwilling listeners he prayeth well, who loveth well, both man and bird and beast.
Dick Nunley teaches English at Berkshire Community College. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or you can listen to us via the Internet. Go to our new webpage at www.enn.com/envshow and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Fishers on the high seas need to catch a lot of fish to stay in business. But there are millions of other fishers who are satisfied with a nice day, clean water, and an occasional rise. Jerry Dennis is the author of The Bird and the Waterfall, A Natural History of Oceans, Rivers, and Lakes. His special place is a tiny creek in northern Michigan.
One afternoon, not long ago, I walked along a creek I know well in its lower reaches, where it flows through a valley of cedars and hardwoods before merging with one of northern Michigan's most famous trout rivers. It is brook trout water, and I was fishing it with a fly rod rigged with a short leader, a split shot, and a hook baited with a worm. I fished slowly upstream to unfamiliar water, through cedar groves and small, hidden meadows, until the creek grew smaller and colder, the pools shallower and less promising. I caught trout, brilliant 7-inchers that came out of the water gyrating so madly I could not get a hand on them, but they were fewer than downstream and smaller. When the creek grew too shallow for even small trout, I stopped being a fisherman and became an explorer. I knew from maps that the creek began somewhere above me in springs. As I walked, I imagined a dramatic origin, a bubbling pool cradled among cedars, with the creek gushing full-grown from it. I was only a little disappointed to discover that, like most streams, this one is formed by the confluence of a dozen minor tributaries, each dividing and dividing again until it becomes so small it is scarcely noticeable, littered with leaning grass, slipping out of sight beneath the moss-covered humps of old trees in the swamp. At each confluence I took the strongest tributary, following first one, then another, until finally the one I chose had no more tributaries. It became too shallow to hide even a fingerling trout, barely deep enough to wet a shoe, and ended finally in a narrow, dark, aromatic gully among the cedars, where the ground was so wet I left a trail of slowly filling footprints. There, in that tiny valley, with sides so close that trees leaned across and touched overhead, I found the springs that form the creek. It begins with whispers and tears, gentle, nearly inaudible trickles seeping from the bank like wounds on a tree, each oozing enough water to nourish patches of swamp buttercups and wild peppermint and hummocks of moss thick as couch cushions. The seeps trickle downhill and gather at the bottom of the gully. It is there that the creek begins. 6 inches wide, half an inch deep, a rivulet trickling over rust-colored pebbles in a skinny bed lined both sides with moss. 100 feet downstream, the rivulet gathers the flow from a dozen other seeps, and the water begins to fill with life. Only big things get easily noticed. If we value just what is worthy of mention in newspapers and on television, it is easy to believe that nothing much matters unless it is large enough to shake the earth. But standing in that gully crowded with growth and dampness, with newborn water leaking from the banks around me, I was reminded that great things often come from humble beginnings. In many ways, it is the creek that makes the river.
Jerry Danis is the author of The Bird in the Waterfall, A Natural History of Oceans, Rivers, and Lakes. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the tragic war in Rwanda has its roots in an overstressed environment. Amory Lovins drives us into the future in his hypercar. And even the endangered wood stork is on the net. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Central Africa, especially Rwanda and eastern Zaire, is close to total meltdown. A brutal war has made international boundaries irrelevant, and chaos is the rule of law. The situation has its roots in years of social and political strife, but environmental degradation has also played a major role. Now, some environmentalists are calling for a new definition of national security, one that places the environment and society on the same level as politics. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Not long ago, Rwanda was known as the Switzerland of Africa. Its hilly and pastoral terrain made it one of the most beautiful areas on the continent. Today, the country is in disarray, fueled by environmental decay, tribal conflict, and an antiquated political system left over from the days of colonization. 2.5 years ago, when violence broke out, an estimated 500,000 to 1 million people perished. The current situation now threatens an area which extends well beyond Rwanda and into surrounding nations. Dr. Bill Weber directs international conservation programs for the Wildlife Conservation Society and spent many years in Rwanda studying gorillas. He says the land just can't handle the population anymore.
One of the problems is that ever since early in the colonial period, people have been predicting a disaster for their region and saying that it's overpopulated. What comes from that is that there are no living Rwandans or people in the region who have ever heard anything but that, and it's a bit like hearing that the sky is going to fall and it's never fallen. Maybe this time it has, and maybe now we're finally seeing that the system can't hold up and that the pressures have finally gotten too great. And we've gone beyond stress to deep fractures and an ultimate breakdown in the system.
Although Rwanda may represent the most extreme example of conflict stemming in part from environmental degradation, many other examples exist. Michael Renner is with the World Watch Institute and author of the new book, Fighting for Survival. He argues countries must adopt a new definition of national security, where environmental and social issues are priorities equal to military might.
Many conflicts are not between different countries now, but they're taking place within countries. In other words, where some kind of guerrilla force may fight against the government, or different ethnic groups may be hostile to each other and engage in violent conflict. And I think not only is it in that sense a different kind of conflict, but often it's not so much a matter of how much in terms of weapons is there to, as the traditional theory goes, deter assaults. But I think we really need to look at the basic the roots really of many conflicts, which go back to environmental reasons, social reasons, and of course, as often is pointed out, the ethnic animosities in many countries.
Rwanda had begun to address its environmental and social ills before the massacres in 1994, but it's among the world's poorest and least developed nations. Dr. Weber says Rwanda relies almost entirely on agriculture, and when space ran out, the country exploded.
You're talking about the most purely agricultural society in the world, I think. Over 95% of the people live off of what they can produce on very small farms. These farms average about an acre in size, less than half a hectare. And at that point, it's really hard to even call it farming. They've basically become gardeners. You simply can't feed a family for a year on less than an acre.
Weber says when the land went beyond its carrying capacity, young and mostly male Rwandans were forced to find work in cities. But little work existed, and Michael Renner says they were caught between urban unemployment and rural starvation.
Soil erosion and soil depletion has played a major role in Rwanda in terms of making it virtually impossible for a growing number of people to basically feed themselves, feed their own family, feed their own community. And the dislocation that resulted from this growing inability to do that, I think, has been clearly one of the central pressure factors in that country, making people more desperate, making them more willing to listen to extremist voices that I think proved very adept in saying, well, look, all these problems that you're facing is really due to this other population group over there, and if you can get rid of them, if you can drive them out of the country, if you can kill them off, that will be your salvation.
And the Rwandan conflict, already having spread to Zaire, has the potential of engulfing other countries in the region as well. In response to increasing environmental stresses, such as those that set off Rwanda, Michael Renner says the global community must begin to view natural resources and social cohesion as key elements to a stable nation. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Cars that can go from coast to coast without refueling? Cars that are so efficient that they collapse the coal, steel, and electric utility industries all at once? Cars that can do all this on the market by the turn of the century? Amory Lovins, a physicist who is director of research at the Rocky Mountain Institute at Snowmass, Colorado, thinks it's all possible. He calls it the hypercar, a concept he's been working on for a number of years, both on his own and in conjunction with the manufacturers.
We are going to improve dramatically the efficiency, cleanliness, performance, and competitiveness of cars that are now, after decades of devoted effort, only able to turn 1% of their fuel energy into moving the driver. This is really not very gratifying. And the key to unlocking several layers of further improvement is to start by making the car several fold lighter weight than now. That doesn't mean making it smaller. It means making it out of extremely strong, crash-worthy materials like carbon fiber composites. And also making the car very slippery, more aerodynamic and with better tires, so it takes very little power to make it go. In fact, four to ten times less. Once we've done that, then it becomes very attractive to use what's called hybrid electric drive. That means the wheels are driven by special electric motors, but instead of hauling around half a ton of batteries that you recharge by plugging in, you make the electricity on board from fuel as needed. This gets the advantages of electric propulsion without the disadvantages of batteries. And once you've done that, the next leapfrog, which is coming at us very quickly, is to make the electricity on board not in a tiny engine or gas turbine, but rather with fuel cells, which use hydrogen or natural gas changed on board into hydrogen to make electricity, hot water, and nothing else.
Lovin says the way the car would work is small electric motors would power each wheel. When the car is decelerating or going downhill, the motors could be generating electricity instead of consuming it. The fuel cell, which burns hydrogen for fuel, keeps generating all the time, so the motorist could park and plug into the grid. Ultimately, according to Lovins, the nation's fleet of privately owned cars would displace the big utility plant as the primary source of electric power.
The next trick you can do is consider your hypercar to be a 20-kilowatt power plant on wheels, which is clean and silent and reliable, and is parked 96% of the time, usually in habitual places. So some entrepreneur or the gas company is going to start providing a natural gas or hydrogen and electric hookup that you plug into at your parking place, swipe your credit card, go off to work, and while you're at work, your second biggest household asset, which was previously idle, is earning you a couple of $1,000 net per year, enough to pay probably over half the cost of financing and depreciating it, which is something like 65% of the cost of owning it. So when you get all through, you've got a hypercar fleet with ultimately five times the generating capacity of the national grid, and you know, it's rent a power plants on wheels.
It sounds pretty good. In that formulation, what does the fuel cell use for its own fuel?
We'll be able to use liquid or gaseous fuels, renewable or non-renewable, and even if we cart hydrogen around in tanks, it'll be a lot lighter and not much more bulky than if we were carrying gasoline in tanks to get the same driving range. The reason is that the fuel cell car is, or hypercar, is so extraordinarily efficient. You get three or four times as much wheel motion or wheel power out of it per unit of energy as you do out of gasoline in today's cars.
The basic problem, says Lovins, is to get auto manufacturing out of the technological niche where it's been stuck. A stagnation similar to what happened to the mainframe computer manufacturers, whose market got swamped by the small personal computer, or PC. He does admit that while substituting the hypercar for what you drive today may stop auto pollution, the other major environmental problems caused by autos remain with us, namely too many vehicles, using up too much space in cities, and on highways that use up too much land. Amory Lovins is the research director of the Rocky Mountain Institute, and I'm Peter Burley. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Wood storks are foraging in the coastal swamps of Georgia and South Carolina. Black and white, they stand almost chest high. Unlike their cousins, the egrets and herons, which can stay on the side of a pond and pluck fish out as they go by, the wood stork picks his way with his bill in the water, snapping up everything he touches that seems to be a fish. But the wood stork's enthusiasm for South Carolina and Georgia can be limited. If it grows too cold, the birds head farther south. Larry Bryan is a researcher with the Savannah River Ecology Lab.
What wood storks do this time of year is they're generally foraging on the coastal plain of Georgia and South Carolina. This is kind of an interesting time for them in that wood storks generally don't tolerate cold weather very well. So we're kind of keeping an eye out on all of the cold fronts that are moving into the area. And what usually happens with this species is once cooler weather hits this region, these storks will shift to the south, going as far south as southern Florida and the Everglades.
Wood storks are protected under the Endangered Species Act. There are only about 6,000 to 8,000 breeding pairs left, but this is a substantial increase from the 3,000 pairs that existed 5 years ago. Bryan is working on a project which, for the first time ever, will track the travels and whereabouts of four wood storks via satellite. The data will go on the lab's website, and you can watch it on your home computer. Once you figure it out, you won't have to read the paper to decide whether it's too cold to go to South Carolina for your winter vacation. If the wood storks have bailed out and gone to the Everglades, change your reservations and go to Florida instead. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for show number 359. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Bullitt Foundation, the Furthermore Division of the Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation for coverage of fisheries issues. And Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-333-9262. C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.